Hey, a couple of announcements. First, we have made a decision with regard to the anniversary party. We will not be having it here on this property. We will be renting a place, probably a hotel conference room or something like that. For that, that's going to be September 22nd, probably beginning at 5:30, something like that. Once we get down a set time, we can let you know. Still a ways off, obviously. Got 4 months. And secondly, if you do desire to contribute to that effort, please make sure that you mark any offering with an anniversary or something to that effect, so the money gets to the right spot. Okay, let's make sure you are in fellowship here, and let's continue on dealing with the first part of chapter 2 here, dealing with this matter of the pre-salvation condition of believers. The idea here is that first we're dealing with this matter of spiritual death and why it's not a cause or caused rather by trespasses and sins. That tends to be the thinking of people, that they sinned and therefore God jammed them and jammed them with death. But that's not the way it happened. That's the reverse of the way it happened. So we left off here rereading our verses, although you were dead in the sphere of your trespasses and sins here. In point 15, again, as we pointed out, some people want to take trespasses and sins as being causative or instrumental. In other words, you were dead because of your sins and trespasses, or you were dead by means of them, they killed you. But neither of those is the case. This is the realm or sphere in which something takes place or exists. And 16, the reality is that trespasses and sins are not the cause of spiritual death. Neither are they the means by which one is rendered spiritually dead. Rather, trespasses and sins are the consequence of spiritual death. Spiritual death comes first, just as what comes first, the apple or the apple tree? Have to have a tree. Romans chapter 5. And you have to have a root cause for sins. They don't come out of nowhere, as it were. They don't just spontaneously generate. Therefore, and this explains all of this in no uncertain terms, I think this verse is as clear as any, that number one, spiritual death came through Adam, but we are not charged with Adam's crime. That is where the doctrine has fallen off. People did not pursue these verses and think through them. Some guy said it once, Adam's original sins imputed, and this gets back to a faulty understanding of what theologians refer to as original sin. We don't, because original sin is a very confusing thing. It doesn't really communicate much and leads to more confusion than it does understanding, I think. So on this account, just as through one man, the one man is Adam, there's no doubt, he's the intermediate agent. The sin nature came into the world. That's the important thing right there. That when Paul deals with this in Romans, and he's very consistent, if he talks about sin as a principle or sin as an act, he uses hamartia without the definite article. If he uses hamartia with the plural with the definite article, he's still referencing personal sins. But hamartia in Romans in the singular with the article always refers to the sin nature. And the sin nature entered into the world. How did it enter in? Well, what happened was Adam is standing there. Of course, what's he doing? Listening to Eve, when he should have been not listening to Eve. And so Adam's standing there, and he determines to sin. Well, Adam sins. And the Adam's sin is then, God has to charge that somewhere. It's not as though sins just, you know, arbitrarily are floating around out here in this cosmic nothingness. Sins are imputed or charged to whoever committed them. And in this case, Adam committed the sin, therefore Adam is charged with the sin. That sin is imputed to his fleshly body. Now, what happens is that there's a reaction. And that leads to the old formation of the old sin nature. The flesh itself becomes sinful. And again, we're going to make distinctions here. Subtle, I know they are, but they are distinctions that you need to have clear in your head. And that is that the flesh became sinful. Matter is not sinful. Flesh isn't evil because it's material. It became evil because it was charged with the sin it produced. And that sin is imputed or charged back to the body. And the body then reacts to this. And it formed the genetic aberration that we call the old sin nature. And out of the old sin nature then comes spiritual death. This is why people are spiritually dead. They are born with an old sin nature. You're never charged with Adam's sin. That's fallacious. And I mean, that theology extends from Dallas to doctrinal churches across the seminaries of this country. And they're all just completely wrong for a couple of reasons. Number one, that makes God a really, really, really cruel person. He's running around charging people with crimes they didn't commit. Is that not unrighteous? You have to acknowledge that's unrighteous. To charge an innocent man with a crime you know he didn't commit. And God knows that the man didn't commit the crime. He's a perfect judge in that regard. And secondarily, Romans is clear here how this works. That Adam's sin wasn't charged to us. It was imputed to him. And out of that came the old sin nature. Out of the old sin nature comes spiritual death. And spiritual death came through the old sin nature. The old sin nature is the intermediate agent that produced spiritual death. Adam's sin is implicated in a distant way because it was imputed to his flesh and then he got a sin nature. Well, guess what? He just passed that sin nature on to the rest of us. Everything can be traced back to Adam. By one man, through one man, the sin nature entered into the world and spiritual death came through the sin nature. As a consequence, spiritual death spread to all men. As a consequence of what? Procreation. We can stop spiritual death from spreading. There's a number of ways we can do this. Chemical castration, turning them into eunuchs, But we can stop them, what's in nature, from spreading. We just have to stop procreating. The human race can stop all this, but they won't, obviously. And part, obviously, too, procreation's part of God's directive will. That's what he told Adam. Be fruitful and multiply. And so, spiritual death spread to all men. Why? The argument here is there is a universal consequence, spiritual death. Therefore, there has to be a universal cause. And the universal cause can be nothing less than the old sin nature itself. That's where spiritual death comes from. So, God never has to charge anybody with anything. All he's got to do is look and see, do you have an old sin nature? And every baby does. Well, one exception. One little baby didn't have the old sin nature. And the world just loved him. And said, we'll follow you everywhere you go and obey your teachings because we know you're righteous. No, not really. So, and on the basis of which, the basis of this spiritual death, all sins. Now we get into the matter of personal sinning, finally. Why do we sin? We sin because we're born sinners. You can't do anything else. Just like I was born a Snyder, I'll die a Snyder. Whatever family you were born into, you had no control over that. And you have no control over being born into Adam. None of us did. So there you got that. So all sinned. For until the law, and this is a reference to the Mosaic law, sin, not the sin nature, sin as a practice, sin as an act, was in the world. The principle of sin existed. But sin is not imputed or charged where there is no law. In other words, if there's no law against going over 70, you can drive whatever speed you want. You can't commit a crime. If that's the rule, if that's the case. But the second there's a law against it, and you violate it, then you can be charged with that crime. And it doesn't matter what it is. And in this case, it's a crime against God. The sins are not, how can you categorize sin until you have a standard that defines sin? And certainly you got to know that there is inherent within the heart of man. Do you think for a second that Cain didn't know that murdering Abel was wrong? Do you think he didn't know that? But yet he did it anyway. And there is a moral nature to man. Man has this inherent thing within him. It's that desire for justice. It's why we like movies like Dirty Harry. It's why we like the Death Wish movies. It's seeing the criminal get it in the end. And because man has a moral nature, whether he likes it or not. Now he can obviously drown that out and ignore it and all manner of things, but he has one. That's why people are outraged when they see the last 12 seconds of a video, but didn't see the 3 minutes leading up to it, because it can just portray the entire wrong thing. Be very careful when you're watching these things on TV, on the news. You're only seeing a brief part of it. You didn't see what led up to that. And many people do a lot of things, but just like the cops need to learn this. It's just like basketball and football. The one that retaliates to the crime is the one that's going to get in trouble, most likely. They're the ones that typically get caught. The one that retaliates. So you got to be able to keep your cool out there when dealing with these explosive situations. You should certainly be praying for the police, the law of the land. The establishment chain of command, we've got mandates to pray for these people. That they'll do their job right. That they'll provide an environment that's, to some extent, crime-free, ideally. But at least where crime's under control. Where you're not fearful of going outside of your house for fear you're going to get shot. Or somebody's going to come and get you. In an unmarked black van, and that's the last we see of you. So we should pray for these men. That God will bless them and help them to keep cool when they need to keep cool. And there are some people, unfortunately, they will not respond. And you have to use more force. But we don't want our cops being abusive any more than I think we want any other authority. So until there's a sin, until there's a law against it, though, you can't charge somebody with murder if there's no law against murder. Now, that doesn't mean it's not morally wrong. It just means that legally you can't charge them with it. So nevertheless, spiritual death reigned from Adam until Moses. Again, the argument is for this to happen, this universal effect. There, what is the universal cause? Even though, and here he clearly says, even over everyone who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam, which is all of us. Nobody committed Adam's sin but Adam. And he spells out here that it was not Adam's sin that gets us into this. I mean, it does in a roundabout way. But that's the distant cause. The proximate cause of spiritual death is the old sin nature. Now, so if you've got one of those, and I'm pretty safe to say that we all have one of them. So you were born spiritually dead. So there you go. Rather, trespasses and sins, again, are the consequence of spiritual death. 17, the first noun, paraptoma, a trespass, is derived from the verb parapipto, literally to fall alongside. However, the noun is never used of literally falling, but of a misstep that results in falling from the right way, resulting in lapses or deviations from what is true, correct, or upright. And at A, a number of interpreters have concluded that this term is used to denote a less serious violation, an inadvertent misstep, an unintentional sin. But New Testament usage demonstrates that this term can certainly involve something more than an inadvertent error. Now, you might do something and not know it. You inadvertently did it. Let's say you're driving, you're not watching the speed limit. Speed limit is 45, and you look down, you find you're going 50, but you weren't aware of it. Now that can happen. I understand. I got stopped. It's been 10, 12 years ago, but got stopped out there in an area I never drove in at all. And he said, "Do you know how fast you were going?" I said, "Yeah, I was going 35." And he goes, "Well, do you know what the speed limit is here?" I said, "No, I haven't seen it marked." And he says, "Well, there were four signs back there you've gone by." And I thought, "You are lying. I know there have not been four signs with the speed limit on." Because I was looking for one, actually. I said, "Yes, sir." You may think he's lying, but you better not charge him with it. Just keep your mouth shut. And I said, "No, I don't really ever drive out in this area. I was out here making a delivery. I can't remember what I was doing, making a delivery for something." And so he said, "Well, just slow it down through here." And I, okay. So he didn't give me a ticket. So if you walk away without a ticket, you got to feel pretty good, especially if you're guilty. So in that regard here, Adam's sin was not simply a lapse in judgment or an involuntary failure. It was a deliberate and willful act that was committed in clear opposition to the revealed will of God. And Paul deals with that in Romans as he contrasts the free gift of salvation through Christ with the transgression of Adam. And it's referred to consistently as a transgression, a stepping where he wasn't supposed to. And that implies more than just, oops, I didn't notice. He knew what the rules were. He knew that you did not eat of that tree. He was clear on that. Adam wasn't fooled. Now, Eve was fooled. Eve got confused. And some of that may have been Adam's fault. Some of it was Eve's fault. And certainly Satan did everything he could to further that confusion. But Eve had the idea, or at least she articulated, you know, from the fruit of that tree, you shall not eat it or touch it, or you die. So she added something to the word of God, which wasn't there. And that's confusing. Because she apparently thought something in the fruit was deadly, that if you touched it, it would kill you. Which is not the case. You could touch it, you could play football with it, you could do whatever you want. You know, they would have to play naked football, but still. You know, they could have done anything, or danced around that tree all night long, did anything they want to. Touch it, you know. But no, the eating was the disobedience was in the eating. And by eating, Adam demonstrated, I don't believe God. He didn't really expect to die, or if he did, he didn't know what death was. And he came to find out very quickly that he had bitten off more than he can chew, to coin a phrase there. So by the transgression of one, the many died. And so all through this, it's called a transgression that results in condemnation. The transgression of one, through the transgression of one, verse 17, death reigned through the one. This was a willful act on Adam's part, and he knew what he was doing. Like I said, Eve was fooled at some level, and Paul alludes to that in the book of 1 Timothy. That the woman was completely faked out by the Satan. Satan outsmarted her. And he didn't outsmart Adam, however. Adam wasn't convinced that if I eat this, something good's going to happen. Eve was convinced something good was going to happen. Adam just looked at the choice and says, do I want to eat this or not? It's stay here in the garden without Eve, or stay with Eve. Let's see, a hot woman, lots of sex. What do you think the man picked? And Eve was a knockout. Eve was the prototype of women. So you know that God did not make a dog. And so Adam had a clear choice. Eve or God's will. Adam knew what he was doing. So you can't make this, that term there is used of a deliberate and willful act. So 18, the first term deals with deviations from the straight and narrow. While the second term, hamartia, deals with thoughts, words, and deeds which miss the mark of righteousness and fail to glorify God. And again, hamartia, the best one analogy I think is that of a target. You're shooting at a target, you either hit it or you miss it. If you miss, that's hamartia. If you hit your target, well, that's the point. Well, 19, the timing of the pre-salvation lifestyle is referenced by the adverb pata, at one time, once, or formerly, which actually covers the time from physical birth until the point one exercises faith in Christ. And 20, although addressed to the Ephesians, theologically it is evident that all unbelievers share the same spiritual death and engage in lifestyles that are dominated by their sinful behaviors, which flow from the source of their own sin natures in the realm of spiritual death. And so you have this vicious cycle. You got a sin nature over here. That's what's it producing? Sins. And sins lead to what? Wrath. And then you're under the wrath of God, obviously, because he makes it plain in Colossians. I think he might in Ephesians too, but I know he does in Colossians. It is because of these things that the wrath of God comes on the sons of disobedience. And he's spelling out these sinful behaviors that result in God's wrath. And then as they live under wrath and discipline and misery and all of that, they're prone to look for happiness. Well, where do they look for happiness if you're an unbeliever? They look to the best thing they know of, their old sin nature. And then they just complete the cycle and just keep doing this over and over again, accumulating more wrath, more sins, more discipline, more judgment. this all flows again, all of it, and then all of this takes place in the big sphere of Adam, of spiritual death, and all that. Well, 21, the verb peripateo, to walk or walk around more literally, first refers to the reality of using one's legs to move from place to place. Figuratively, it's used to denote how one conducts his life, his habitual way of living. And so we talk about a person's walk. Why? Because people habituate certain things. They habitually go to certain places. They habitually engage in certain behaviors. And all of us are, you know, fighting, hopefully, the old sin nature, which salivates its lusts. And you try to stay on top of those. But inevitably, I don't care how great a believer you are. I don't care how much doctrine you have. You'll be fighting this monster till the day of your death. And there'll be areas where you may make great strides and you may say, wow, I've really grown in that area. I'm not even tempted to sin in that area now. And that may be. Don't worry, it could come back. Just because you're not tempted right now doesn't mean you never will be. But the fact is, you're going to struggle. People call them habitual or besetting sins or whatever you want to call them. But you've got ingrained areas. I've got ingrained areas that are just very difficult to us to ever conquer. But they can be conquered. That's the whole message of Romans 6, positional truth and all of that. They can be conquered. We no longer have to obey the old sin nature. Now, we may choose to obey it, but at least we know what we're doing. And you say, well, no, I never sin intentionally. Really? Never? Not once? Not one time have you did something knowing it was wrong. Just never. Oh, I don't believe you. I think you're sinning now. So, how are we going to live our lives? How are we going to walk? There's a path. The psalmist talks about this all the time. Your word is a lamp unto my feet and a light to my what? Path. Put your path before me. Make straight paths for your feet. What is this all about? Simplify, 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 simplify. Walk the easiest lifestyle that you can walk in the Christian life. Why? Because the Christian life is enough of a burden in some ways of itself. You have to still take the yoke on you. The yoke is a yoke. And the yoke's no joke. And you have to be willing to commit and perform. And when you're distracted and when your focus isn't right and your priorities aren't right, well, you're not going to excel in that. There's just no question. So how are we to live our lives? How are we going to walk? Well, Paul is going to say later, God's got an entire set of good works he planned out for you specifically. And you're supposed to walk in them. You better figure out what they are and get busy on them. Because other than that, you're wasting your time as a believer. This is not fulfilling the phase two mandates that we have. If we don't know what we're supposed to be doing and then executing. So 22, this verb can be followed by the preposition kata, according to a standard, to denote the norms or standard by which one conducts himself. The standard which one chooses to accept and obey. Mark chapter 7. This was in the exchange between Jesus and the legalists of the religious world there. Mark 7:5. The Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders? But eat their bread with impure hands." And again, we're not talking here about washing for the sake of hygiene. That's not what they're discussing. They're discussing ritual washings that you got to do. Oh, I was out at the market. I've been with some Gentiles. I may have got some cooties. And I got to wash them off. That's what they're talking about. This ritual washing that absolves you of, you know, whatever. Not a hygienic washing. But he says it's clear that their lifestyles are such that they don't do this regularly. They could see this, that the disciples. And it was happening again. They were eating, in verse 2, their bread with impure hands, that is, unwashed. Again, not hygienically unwashed. He's not saying, why don't they Purell? He's saying, why don't they observe these rituals that we have that you have to do in order to be a successful Jew? So there they walk. Now Romans deals with this in terms of the Christian walk. Romans 8:4. Beginning in verse 3 here. What the law could not do. Well, what was it the law couldn't do? Well, number one, the law cannot produce righteousness. All it can produce is obedience at best. And that's not unqualified righteousness. The law can't save. We know that. But even worse, and why can't it save? Because it can't produce righteousness. All it can do is tell you what to do and then penalize you if you don't do it. The law itself is an element of wrath. Because it provides not only the righteous standards you've got to live by, but then the punishment if you don't. And very much the Mosaic Covenant was a conditional covenant. If you do this, you obey this and this and this and this and this, then I will bless you. The covenant with Abraham, the new covenant, these are unconditional covenants. There's no, although the covenant with Abraham at first started out as a conditional covenant, it became unconditional once Abraham complied with his part of it. Then God said, okay, now I'm going to do all of my part. It's no longer, there's no more contingency factor. You left your family, you left your home, and you went to a land which I showed you, and that was what God, and finally, and of course he didn't get all these blessings till he finally separated from Lot. And then, of course, all the covenant became unconditional at that point. The new covenant, it's unconditional. It doesn't say, if you do thus and such. It says, I will put my spirit in them. And they, I will be their God and they will be my people. Nobody will have to teach them about my laws. This will be internal to the person. And that's what Christianity is. It's the beginning of the fulfillment of the new covenant that was promised to the Jews, but we get to participate in. So, what can't the law do? Well, it can't do a lot of things, but God did. He condemned sin in the flesh. So that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us. Might be contingent upon whether or not we walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. If we don't walk according to the flesh, if we walk in fellowship, order our lives in fellowship. But this means staying on top of your Christian life. It means you can't just keep sinning at will and never acknowledge it or deal with it. You have to walk that walk. But according to the Spirit, then the law of God is fulfilled in us. Then we're producing the righteousness that the law looks for. As you obey, without thinking about it, hopefully, if you're in fellowship, you're not sitting there constantly thinking, oh, I got to obey the golden rule. I got to do unto others. No, if you're in fellowship, and you'll have these opportunities, these tests, whereby you'll be able to do that, if you choose to. Again, still contingent on volition. Anytime you see this might be, you know it's a subjunctive. And that means there's a volitional factor involved, most likely. And there is. Here, and then also the last one, 2 John 1:6. And again, the lifestyle gets into this matter of obedience, and that is what love is. This is how the believer manifests his thankfulness to God for what all he's done. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. We order our lifestyle according to the royal imperatives, and in certain cases avoid those things that are prohibited, the royal prohibitions. So this is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, that you should walk in it. And this gets in again back to the royal imperative. So 23, in this case, Paul uses two coordinated phrases, both introduced by kata, according to the standard, to describe their pre-salvation lifestyle as it related to the world around them and as it related to the forces of darkness. You formerly walked according to the course of this world. And then, according to the prince, the authority over the air. This guy has power, but we'll get into him in a little bit. But now let's deal with this matter of why people organize their lives around cosmic principles. And why I have to constantly stand up here and say, quit doing that. Because this is the nature of the world. It is designed to convince people that a certain lifestyle is fine. It's in fact desired or accepted. When in fact, if it doesn't match up to the biblical lifestyle and the priorities aren't straight, I have to get up and say, no, it's not. It's not accepted. God has a particular lifestyle that believers are supposed to walk. And their behaviors demonstrate what they believe. You can't hide your belief system. It's manifested in your lifestyle. And how do I know what people believe? I can just observe their actions. And I'm not talking about going around sinfully judging people, imputing motive where I don't know it. That's not what I'm talking about. But I'm talking about somebody that they own 4 different vintage cars. Well, what's important to them? I don't have to think very hard to figure that out. I can look at a person who goes on vacation every 60 days. They take a week off. Well, I know what's important to them. And it's not what they're doing in that 60 days. It's that week off all the time. Now, again, is there anything wrong with taking a vacation? No. But how much vacations do you need? We live in Babylon, for God's sake. You think Paul wouldn't have loved a vacation? Hey, can I get out of this prison for a little bit? I'd like to go to soak in the Dead Sea or something. You know? No. Well, here we'll get into the standard of the world and what they're doing. So 24, it should be observed again that the preposition kata can denote the standard by which one operates. However, since its root meaning is down, it can also shade into the idea of being dominated or controlled by the object of that preposition. And in fact, that's what comes to happen for the unbeliever. He's dominated or controlled by the cosmic system around him because he doesn't... Number one, he can't really effectively break from it. And number two, deep down, the problem is for the negative, they don't want to break from it. They think this is all fine, the way the world is. And if you can't look around in this world and see that there's something really, really wrong, lots of things that are really, really wrong. Now, what are the cosmos focusing on the things that are really wrong? Is it the lack of justice? Is it the quick execution of justice they bemoan? No. It's climate change. The climate's changing. Woe is us. Oh, well, we're not destroying the world with our sinful activities and murder and all of this. We're going to act outraged over the cosmic system in America. We're outraged that Russia would meddle in an election. You've got to be kidding. How can you say this with a straight face? Either you don't know history... And what we have done repeatedly, and meddling in election is nothing compared to the things we've done. We've brought up and taken down entire dynasties. We have brought up and taken down people at will, at our whim, when it suits our purpose. And by our, I mean obviously the powerful rulership behind the scenes of our government that makes choices like this. Why are we going to go after this person and not this person? Saddam Hussein, remember him? He was the root of all evil. And all this terrorism was laid at his foot. Even though, again, let's not trouble ourselves with the facts, that all these Saudi Arabians were terrorists, not Saddam Hussein. Now, I'm not saying he never engaged in this or anything else. I'm just saying we conveniently ignored the truth. And then, of course, you get a scapegoat, and then you put the scapegoat up, the straw man, you beat him to death until you've taught him a lesson. And that's what we did. We did it with the Shah of Iran. We did it with the Iran-Contra. We pulled all kinds of stunts, this nation, as detailed in many ways in that study on the U.S. and prophecy. Disturbing as it is, you've got to know that we are doing a lot of dirty deeds. And we've got a lot of people purveying all of our nastiness around the globe. It's not just happening here. But what's going on? Well, we don't know. But why do we hear every day? Border wall. That's the biggest thing. Now, I'm not saying we don't need protection on our border. Don't get me wrong. But this is a smokescreen to distract people from the more important issues. This Mueller report, how long did it take and what have we gotten for our tax dollars? Well, we can't exonerate it. First, that's never the job of a prosecutor. The prosecutor's job is not acquitting the defendant. His job is to charge him with a crime. So that was a smokescreen. We cannot exonerate. Oh, what prosecutor can? Just a double talk. And the American people are like, well, see, he said he couldn't. No prosecutor can do that. That's the job of the defense attorney, is to exonerate the guy if he's not guilty. What they did say was we can't find any crimes we could charge this guy with. But do we think he might have done some shady stuff? Have you never done anything shady yourself? Have you never been paid under the table for a job and not reported it on your taxes? That's just as shady as other things people do. And I've done it. It wasn't very much money, but then I realized, well, this is wrong. I can't keep doing this. So stop it. But people do shady things all the time. And what have we gotten out? What have we really found out? Nothing. And so now we'll have an impeachment proceeding and another smokescreen, and here we go. But what's really happening in the world around us? What's going on out there? Well, here the idea of being dominated or controlled comes into play in this word, this preposition. So thus, to live one's life according to the age of the world indicates that the norms and standards that govern the behaviors of unbelievers may, and often do, come to dominate and even control them. They, in a sense, create their own prison that they have to live in. Creed had a song called that, My Own Prison. You essentially create your own prison by your deeds, and then you have to live in it. We call it, you made your bed, now lie in it. So they begin to accept these norms and standards. So they end up, what happens is you go along, and then one day you wake up and you're PC principal. And you're so politically correct, you can't think anything wrong or tolerate anything wrong. Well, 26, the standards by which the unregenerate live are defined by the phrase translated as the course of this world, which actually uses two different Greek terms to refer to the world. 27, the first term translated course is the noun ion, which is used of time. It can be used of time both in the past, say for instance Luke 1:70, gives you an idea of just time in a general sense. Here, prefixed with the preposition, or preceded by the preposition apo, he spoke to his old holy prophets from a time or an age. And they just translated of old, because they know it's referring to ancient time, the previous history. That he spoke to the prophets previously in history is the way you could translate that, and you'll be just fine. It's also used of the present time, Romans 12:2. This is in our mandate to not be conformed. Do not be conformed to this age. And there it's used of ion. Now it means time right now, the present age in which we live. You're alive. Generally, you're going to get about 70 years on this planet. You might get a little more. But you're going to get about 70 years, and that's going to be it. And I got to looking around, I thought, back when I calculated it, and of course I didn't start thinking about it, I think, until about the time I hit 60. And then I thought, 60, huh? Mm. So I've lived 6/7 of my life here. And 6/7, that's about, 70%, roughly. And now that I'm 65... I've lived more of it. And so, realistically, most of my life's over. I hope I did spent the time I spent doing the right things, because it's gone. I can't change it now. And so I did, or I tried to anyway. So there it's used of the present time. It's also used of the future in John, say, 6:51. And very often here, in these contexts, it'll be prefixed by or preceded by a preposition eis. I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. If anyone eats this bread, he will live forever. That's into the age. And there he's talking about future, obviously. He's going to live in the future. And the bread which I give also for the life of the world is my flesh. And so it's also used of a segment of time as a unit of history. And then, although that term was used in Hellenistic literature, the magical papyri and later in Gnostic circles, to refer to a personal power, a lesser deity, Paul never uses the term in that way. Now, that usage is found in all these other kinds of literature. But Paul doesn't use it in that way. He never uses ion. And some interpreters, believe it or not, want to read that in here, that somehow he's referring to some personal deity. But in this case, he's not, certainly. B, in spite of the fact that the readers would likely have heard the term used in that way, Paul only uses it in Ephesians of time past, Ephesians 3:9. Again, just very much in the way it's used in the other places. Very consistent with that usage. Ephesians 3:9, and to bring to light what is the administration of the mystery, which for ages has been hidden in God. That's from the ages, most likely. I bet you've got another. Yeah, apo. From the ages. In other words, from the past. It's been hidden. He uses it of the present age. Well, that we're going to get that in our verse here. Ephesians 2:2. In which you formerly walked according to the course of this world. That is, according to the present way the world is. That's how you lived. You emulated. That's all unbelievers can do is just emulate what they're taught. And that's why, you know, in your early, more formative years, who has the most influence over you? Your parents. And then, obviously, as you go into the school system, they have influence over you. Not necessarily good influence. This idea that the school system's here to run your children and take them away from you and absolve you of all responsibility is wrong. That's not what it's there for. It's there to educate, not to train. And then it's used of the age to come. We saw that at the end there of verse 21 of the previous chapter. Not where he's going to be exalted above every name that is named. Not only in this age, but in the age to come. And so very much, again, Paul uses this just as other authors use it. So see, the noun ion is defined as a particular period of time in history that is characterized by specific ideas, views, habits, beliefs, and overt behaviors. See, some behaviors that are acceptable now, 50 years ago, were not acceptable. If you did these kinds of behaviors in public, you not only would have been chastised, you would have run the risk of violence and other things. That the cosmos now embraces the lowest common denominator of humanity. The cesspool that is humanity, we keep seeking the bottom of it. And I say we, not us believers, hopefully. But the cosmos in general, that's all they're doing is on this downward spiral like your toilet flushing. That's where history's headed for the human race. It's going to be flushed. And people are just not prepared for this. They just think this is going to go on just like it does. I hear Ron get up there and say this, but nothing changes every day. Every day the same. Well, we'll see. Let's see how long it lasts. So 28, therefore the ion includes all the thoughts, opinions, beliefs, speculations, impulses, habits, and lifestyles present in the world at any given time, which may be impossible to accurately define, but which still constitute a real and effective power that permeates the world in which people live. This affects people. The climate in which you live affects... Well, one of the things we're going to see here that becomes pretty evident in this is that Paul deals with the three primary influences on the believer and doesn't attribute all of it to any one of them. He acknowledges the influence that all three have. And so, if you get tunnel vision, you say, well, everything's the result of demonic activity. And that's why it explains everything. It doesn't explain everything. You have a world system that also acts, and it sort of has a mind of its own, we might say. And then you've got a sin nature, and guess what? It's got a mind of its own. And so the demons have minds of their own. So we're subjected to these, one, animate, and then two sort of inanimate things. Your own sin nature, and then the world system in which we live. So here, 29, the term zeitgeist, time spirit, literally, similarly refers to the general intellectual, moral, and cultural climate of a particular period in history. So 30, thus all unbelievers live according to the standards of the prevailing spirit of the age. What is it we're taught very early on? Fit in. Don't be different. Don't buck the system. Don't think for yourself. We're taught very early on, from the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Cat Stevens. And so people want to fit in. Peer pressure. You want to, so that's why people won't dress. Now today, you know, all the nonconformists look the same. That backfired. And in the 60s, didn't all the nonconformists start looking the same kind of? Long hair, sandals, bell bottoms? And so people don't want to look different. I remember, I was a child. I went to school. We weren't rich. My dad, we were in the Air Force. I don't know how they survived on the tech sergeant salary, which I think was about $400 or $500 a month at that time, and raised four kids. This is just beyond me. I know things were cheaper. I mean, I know gas was 20 cents a gallon. That makes a big difference. 20 cents as opposed to 270. That's obviously food was cheaper. Hell, cigarettes were only a quarter a pack. Because my dad smoked them, so I happen to know that. I didn't. I tried it once and got caught and didn't like it anyway. So then once I got caught, I sure didn't like it because I got punished. So, that's their parents exercising their right to run your life. You can't tell me what to think. Yes, I can. I'm your parent. Until I'm 18, until you're 18, I can tell you any damn thing I want. And you better orient to it. Because that's what the job of the child is. The job of the parent is not to be the child's friend. That's another whole spirit of our age. Oh, you got to be friends with your children. You want them to like you. No. No, that's the wrong approach completely. That completely has it completely backwards. You want them to respect you. Whether they like you or not is irrelevant. But if you set a standard and do the right things, as they grow up, kids notice it. Kids are more perceptive than people think. Kids pick up on stuff. They know who cares about them and who doesn't. They have some idea of what's important and what isn't. You say, well, they're kids. They don't really know that. Oh, yeah, they do. Kids can see things and think through things. I could figure things out as a child, and I'm sure you could too. And so, we want to set an example. And then hopefully at the end of it all, as the Bible says, when they're old, they won't depart from it. That's your hope. That's the proverb. When they're old, they won't depart from it. Ecclesiastes says, sometimes they will. So, the Proverbs are general rules of thumb, but they have exceptions, as we know. So, thus all unbelievers, again, live according to the standards of the prevailing spirit of the age. Peer pressure and all that works at keeping people in line. You don't want to say the wrong thing. You don't want to wear the wrong clothes. You don't want to have the wrong hairstyle. And of course, people follow along. I remember back there was some point, and I think it was in the late 70s or maybe early 80s, probably late 70s, where every man out there, a bunch of men decided they had to have perms. And I just thought, I'd rather go back to being a hippie with a ponytail than have my hair look that way. Now, if you like a perm, we're not here to judge you. A little bit we are, but shame on you. No. But I'd see all these guys go out and they perm their hair, and I think, what is this? Why do you? Well, it was the style. It was the spirit of the age. You got to be with it. You dress a certain way. Remember when the bell bottoms couldn't get any bigger? They just kept flaring out until they'd start out. And now we've gone back. Now it's straight legs, skinny jeans, because that's the important thing. Is it? No, not really. So I don't let the cosmos dictate fashion to me. Why would I? There are unbelievers functioning in the realm of spiritual death, trying to figure out a world that they can't even figure out. And you look at the lifestyles of unbelievers. Why do these movies make so much money? People are lined up for these things before they open. This is the big deal. I got to go watch a movie. Why? Do you need? Can't be alone with your thoughts for an hour or so? Can't reflect on the weightier matters of life? Your soul? What's spiritual? Where the world's going? No, I got to have mindless entertainment. And what's the entertainment telling us? That the world's ending. That's the constant theme in many of these movies. There's this evil force. It's going to destroy everything, by God. But yet we can't talk openly of the devil. But we can speak of the Avengers because they're real. Are they? I don't think so. So they are influenced, dominated, and even controlled by the thinking of spiritually dead, spiritually blind unbelievers. Well, I know what happens if a blind man follows a blind man. That part I'm pretty clear on. 2 Peter 3 and 4. Now, what is the predominant spirit of our age? Well, right here it is. It's mocking unbelief, fueled by beliefs in uniformitarian evolution. That's where the cosmos is. The scientific community makes no secret about it. They joke about it all the time on the Big Bang Theory, but God's generally the butt of the joke. They don't think that God created all this. They'll look for alternate explanations till they're dead. And never be able to find any because it's a finite, deterministic world that God has created. And they can go look all they want. Again, my question is there life? Is there intelligent life out there? Hopefully, because there's not much here. But there isn't. They can't even find water on a planet. And in a bare, an atmosphere that would support life as we understand. And so now they can look, although you set your stars in the nest in the heavens, from there I'll pull you down. And pretty soon we're going to have enough satellites up there that everybody can be watched 24/7 all the time. And that's kind of where we're headed anyway. I mean, Big Brother, 1984 was nothing compared to what we live with. They have monitors everywhere. So again, another reason if you're a believer, well, make your lifestyle righteous among the Gentiles. First, you may be watched. And again, when you see this stuff, I've seen it before. I've done things. And then when I see it on another people, it's not quite as attractive. It's kind of gross. And that makes me stop and think, well, you know, God, that behavior does not look good on me either, does it? So try not to do that. 2 Peter 3:3-4. Knowing this first of all. Why are we to know this right out of the chute? Because this is the intellectual and moral environment in which we're going to be living as people in the last days. That in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking. Following after their lusts. What is the cosmos essentially preached since the 60s? Do your own thing, and if it feels good, do it. And Sheryl Crow seconded that with, these are the days when anything goes. And so this is the mentality out there. Do what you want. Don't worry about it. Make yourself happy. Find your own bliss. Well, really, that's what life is about. That's what they think it's about. That's what they say it's about. That's what I see all the time in the commercials, living the good life. You got to have the good insurance. You got to have the good beer. You got to have the good makeup. You got to have the good life. And indulge yourself. And because why? Because you're the most important person. That's the mentality that governs unbelievers. And why are they having these constant conflicts? Because everyone thinks the universe revolves around them. And guess what? We find out the universe revolves around Jesus Christ and we get to be a part of it. The world, they're still out there looking out for Bachman Turner, looking out for number one. This is the nature of the game. Get ahead at all costs. Again, I love that old saying, get what you can what you get, sit on the lid and burn the rest. And that is the way to go about life. And that was the saying back in the 80s, wasn't it? I got mine. Well, that's what's important, is you getting yours. They're mocking, following after their own lusts, whatever their lusts tell them to do. And we see this now in all manner of sexual deviance. We see this in the violence that governs everything. You can be driving along and the next thing you know, road rage, you're dead. Somebody decides to kill you. And it appears that most everybody's armed, whether they're supposed to be or not. And they're all too quick to grab the gun and pull it out. Every little incident. See, and this is one of the things you better figure out as a believer and as a person. That every little incident, one little wrong word, one little wrong action, one little wrong facial expression can escalate this stuff immediately. And boom, you've got a flash fire. And anger goes just like that. And people are giving into it more and more and more. Neil Young, It's an Angry World. I only cite these things because the music demonstrates what the Bible already says. And the world's getting angrier. And for those of us who have an anger grid, that's really rough. Because now I not only have to fight my own grid, I have to fight these other angry people out there. And I'm trying not to be an angry person. Sometimes not as hard as others, but I'm trying. I know it's a sin. I know I'm not supposed to give in to it. So here, knowing they are following their own lust and saying, where is the promise of His coming? Oh, we've been hearing this since we were children. My dad said this. My mom said this. We just don't believe it. That's the whole thing. This is a mock of the fact that the second advent, or the rapture, either one, whichever one they're mocking, probably both, isn't going to exist. That it isn't really going to happen. And again, when I saw them start making fun of the rapture on Saturday Night Live, I thought, oh boy, here are the mockers. I like good comedy as well as the next guy. But what passed for comedy back in the 50s and 60s and all now is, well, people won't watch it any longer. Because they're into whatever it is that passes for comedy. I look at stuff and I think, how is this funny? These are the sitcoms. How is that funny? I watch some of it and it just makes me want to smack them. And to me, that's not funny when you're sitting there. This isn't entertainment. I just want to smack them. So where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, everything all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. That's their uniformitarian worldview. That nothing changes. Essentially, this denies catastrophes ever occur in its broadest sense. So Mount Vesuvius never blew up, didn't kill all those people. Hawaii, those volcanoes aren't bothering anybody. Mount St. Helens had no effect whatsoever on the world around it. A massive earthquakes, Richter scale 8 and up, these don't really bother people or hurt them. San Francisco wasn't destroyed by a massive earthquake. That never happened. Because the uniformitarian thing says everything pretty much stays the same. Nothing really changes. And that's not even true at a physical level in the world, and it's certainly not true in the intellectual realm of the world out there. That things are constantly changing, in fact. And so everything continues just as it was. Nothing has changed. This is, again, and why is he arguing here against a lengthy world age? Because it is a finite age. It's fixed. God has a time frame for all of this. This is why if you study the Bible at all in the New Testament, you have to come to the conclusion that God's got a time for everything. Or you could read Ecclesiastes 3. For everything there is a season. And a time for every purpose under heaven. And what is the time? Well, in our time, the idea is nothing ever changes. Nothing's going to change. The implication being nothing's going to change. And that's why they're mocking his coming, because that is a catastrophic event from their standpoint. And as we see when we look in the book of Revelation, where are these people? In the rocks and dens and caves of the earth, calling for the mountains to fall on them. And hide them from the fact that nothing ever changes. No. Hide us from the vicious little lamb. I mean, he is seriously vicious. He's going to destroy the world. So this is the age in which we live. This uniformitarian evolutionary world that they have posited now. And said, okay, if you don't buy this, you're not a part of the intelligent scientific community. No, you're not a part of the darkness that permeates unbelieving lives. If you don't believe all that. Okay, well, whoops, our time is gone. We are going to have to stop there. And we will continue on here dealing with this. Don't worry, it only gets worse from here. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these matters. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our understanding and spiritual growth. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.